There is more quiet. Hello. The children, the young people in the back of the audience, could you please be seated? We would appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
What are you doing on the chair? Yes. Fucking hell.
How are you?
I'm there.
You are my bodyguard.
Thank you.
Hi there, stranger. How are you?
I'm not here at all.
Hey, thank you. If you wouldn't mind, I'd be very grateful.
How are you?
Thank you so much.
How are things going?
Nothing new there, then.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. We'd like to get this program started. Thank you. All right, we're ready to start our program, The Next Generation GTLD Directory Services.
So, let's get started. Good morning and very warm welcome to the Next Generation Data Directory session that we have today. My name is Jean-François Baril, and I'm very pleased, and I would say even very honored to be the facilitator for this expert working group. This session today should serve basically two main purposes. Obviously, one is to update the ICANN community on our progress as a working group. The second one is even more important, and it is to collect your input and insights on critical issues that we are currently working on. As such, we have built the following agenda for this session. First, a rapid introduction and background on the origin and purpose of this working group. Then, a structured dialogue with the community. And then wrapping up and proposing the next step looking forward. So, why are we here today as a working group? If you remember, last October, Fadi Shehadeh announced a very ambitious plan for addressing one of ICANN's most controversial issues, but at the same time, very strategic, WHOIS. Despite many years of passionate debate, maybe I should say decade, and encouraged also by the WHOIS review team report, it was recognized that WHOIS could not be easily fixed. Instead, Fadi suggested that a fresh and clean slate approach will be much more efficient and effective, specifically looking forward to the new, in the context of the new GTLD and the Internet of tomorrow. ICANN board announced last December the creation of this expert working group with a strategic direction to help redefine the purpose and provision of GTLD registration data. If we are well articulated, transparent, obviously, and logical, it is our expectation that GNSO will take our input, output seriously. It is also our expectation that this blueprint will help as a foundation for GNSO to create a new global policy for GTLD directory services. Now, this EWG incredible team, as you can see, we are very packed on the stage, so it's really like a team. We are 15 members, including Steve Crocker and Chris Dispan, also serving as a board liaison, and in addition, we have the chance to have five precious ICANN staff. As you can see, very diverse team coming from business and non-business backgrounds from the five different continents, strong core technical expertise covering all spectrum of different cases like IP, trademark, data protection and privacy, law enforcement, and of course registrars and registries. But above all, and at the risk to embarrass their humility, they all come with very strong leadership skills as well. Our mode of operation, well, we are now basically 6 weeks in our job and operating via weekly teleconferences, and so far three face-to-face meetings, LA, London, and obviously these days Beijing. We have been conducting a comprehensive review of issues surrounding the requirements for GTLD registration data directory services. But we have also found very relevant to understand various use cases while challenging the current logical flow around these different processes. And always having in mind the strategic question of what, who, where, how, and when. All of that in the best interest of the overall ICANN community. Nevertheless, we have to be very humble and admit that despite very intense work and effort, we are still in the exploration, reviewing, challenging phase. But at the same time, I strongly believe that we are coming to a very good and solid common understanding as well. As Beijing represents a unique opportunity for the EWG to capture the tremendous heart and brain power that exists in this ICANN community. We would like now to invite all of you to a very open dialogue. Even so, at this stage, direct input will be more useful, we think, to us than just questions. Six of our members here have volunteered to lead six of the most relevant issues that we are currently examining. So now let me make as a first disclaimer. Each of the presenters will speak in the name of the overall expert working group and not in their own name. I think this is important also to understand. So for each of the six topics, we'll have 2 minutes. As an introduction, 8 minutes to collect your input. In addition, we have prepared an extra 10 minutes for you to have the chance to express your extra thoughts, which will not be able to fit in the above structure. And in case this is not going to be sufficient, we have also prepared an email address for you to post your input and questions. Now, Chris, here sitting on the floor, has accepted the difficult challenge to be the moderator, but I know very well that he really, really enjoys it. So, Chris, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean-Francois. Morning, everyone. Very quickly before we start, I just wanted to do a couple of logistical bits. So the first speaker is going to be Rod, I think, yeah? And it's going to be usage requirements. So he's going to do 2 minutes. We've got two microphones in the usual places, for those of you who are used to this. Please come to the microphone. We only have a small amount of time. I appreciate that there will be lots of people who want to say things, but if you could keep your comments short, we're really, really interested in your comments, and they're going to be addressed as a specific question following Rod's particular presentation. Then we'll move on to the next one. We do have a 10-minute timer, which will go off at the end of 10 minutes, and we would like to try and get through it. Don't forget there's 10 minutes at the end to sweep up. So with that, Rod, over to you.
Thank you, Chris, and good morning, everybody. Glad to be here. As Jean-Francois was mentioning earlier, one of the ways we're tackling this very large issue is to look at the problem holistically, take a look from all angles, from everybody who is involved, try and figure out why, when, where, how, etc., that people need to get access to domain registration data, the purpose for it, and understand that from a fairly balanced perspective, and have divided this the work up into several examining several use cases. And this drives usage requirements, which will then drive what we need to develop from both a systemic perspective as well as feeding into potential policy recommendations and policy questions. So this really just involves going through all the various angles, looking at the uses, identifying the areas where people are doing things today and where we might be able to take things tomorrow, and classifying the various people, processes, systems, et cetera, that are using this kind of information and what they're using it for. So that's a very brief introduction as to what we're doing. We have a discussion question around just the whole perspective around collecting, storing, and provisioning of this data. Is this necessary? Why is it necessary? And think of this from your usage perspective. What are the uses you have for this kind of data, and what do you need it for?
Thanks, Rod. So 10 years this has been going on. Wouldn't it just be easier to abandon the whole thing? Do we really need do we need to collect the data and store it? Obviously not. We could probably move on if that's the case. Yeah. In fact, why don't we just cancel the whole thing? Right. Should have known. Right. Steve, go ahead.
Thank you. Steve Metallitz, a member of the intellectual property constituency. I want to thank the expert group, also, first of all, for all the time and effort that they are putting into this, and I think it's going to make, I hope it will make a very important contribution to resolving some longstanding problems. I just wanted to say on this issue of why collection, storage, and provision of the data is necessary to, I'm sure you've already heard from among your members about how this is being used in business, how it's being used in order to enforce intellectual property rights, how the data is used for law enforcement purposes, how the data is used for technical purposes as well. But I hope you'll also bear in mind that one of the important aspects of access to this data is for, to use a phrase that's become very trite within ICANN, but I think you will find may have been first used in this context with regard to who is, accountability and transparency. And the people who use the internet, the consumers, the families, the parents, have a real need to know who they are dealing with online. They need to know that for their business transactions, economic transactions, also for how their children use the internet. So it's important to keep those individual consumers in mind as well as the business uses and the technical uses and so forth. So one question you might ask yourself is, what are the categories of people who shouldn't have access to information about who is registering to make?
We're coming to, that is one of our slides, Steve, so thank you. Ray, and then Amadeo.
Thank you, Chris. All kudos and thanks assumed, so I'll proceed. Yes, you need to collect it, and you need to collect it just from the beginning perspective of identifying who is a successful applicant and who the people are that you would need to do business with just to maintain the operation of the GTLD. And you're going to have a section later on storage. And I'm in provision, I'd like to change the thrust of that just slightly in that what the output of this system really is a series of reports from a database. And so what you're really looking at is how you would shape that. And it starts to allude to some of the things that Steve was talking about. And so that in the end, all of the information you collect may not be available to everyone, and it may be available in compartmentalized type things, depending upon the nature of the person that is, needs to access the data. And I'll, you're going to do that later, but I just wanted to put
Thanks.
That out there right now. So the why, I think, is really self-explanatory. And the real question is, what are you going to collect? And whether or not some of that's the things that are later reported can actually be generated by computation or amalgamation.
Thank you. Amadeo?
Okay. Does it work?
Hold on. Try again.
La, 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 la.
Yes, you're well done.
Sorry. That was my comment. No. well, it couldn't be much farther than that, unfortunately. No, the question is that, from my perspective, recollection of storage are not the controversial parts. Indeed, we may discuss whether fax in the 21st century makes any sense or not. But even if it doesn't, it's not controversial, it's not something that will raise serious problems. I think we all agree that quality, high-quality registration data, accurate registration data is necessary to be collected from the registrant, is necessary to store that. And even, I think that most of us agree that it should be accessible to, at very least, some accredited parties. So I think the real challenge is on whether we should grant access to some verified parties or some categories, or we should give access to everybody through universal publication. But quite frankly, I would recommend the group not to spend too much energy into collection and storage part, because there are some technical issues that should be improved, but it's not the crash of the of the problem here.
Okay, thank you. There are some questions around storage in respect to how you store it, and which we're going to come to a bit later on. Ms. Kleinman.
I find myself disagreeing with Amadeo. This is troubling. I'm Kathy Kleiman. And I do think we should be talking about collection and storage and what we're collecting and why we're collecting it. I went back to some of the old techies years ago, and I said, why? Why do we have these particular data elements in, and who? What data was in there? And they looked at me. It goes back to the NSFNet days, apparently, and this was their business data. They were at MIT, IT. I think I was talking to Scott Bradner at the time, so it was Harvard IT. This was his business office, and he was the technical contact for any problems. So I'm truly, truly hoping that you're going to be looking at the data elements, the collection of the data, and why. Why we're collecting it, for what purpose. I think all these issues are open to you. I'm glad you're looking at it. I'd like to hear more about what you're thinking on that.
I'd like to hear more about what you think.
Well, I'm concerned about accountability and transparency as the standard for registering data, because I think of the Internet the way I used to use it, starting in 1982 when there was no commercial speech online. It was non-commercial speech, personal, political. I still do a lot of non-commercial speech, as does the non-commercial users constituency. And accountability and transparency is not the standard for speech. In fact, many countries protect the rights of minorities, of dissidents, even of parents and mothers to say things without putting their address on it. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Ray, you wanted to respond to something Kathy said, and then gentlemen over there, come to you in a second.
First of all, I got a question. Are you actually going to have a session, a question on collection itself? Or is this the collection question?
Yes, we have a set. Yes, we do. Carry on.
Okay. So part of the answer to the collection question is actually involved in what you're going to be reporting in the provision question. And that also goes back to requirements that are negotiated in regards to requirements of, for example, law enforcement being able to get some kind of information you may not otherwise collect it. Also, the conduct and the operation of the GTLD, for example, an abuse point of contact, those are requirements that are generated by other things in the system. And so by the pure act of registration, you wouldn't necessarily collect that.
Okay.
So you have to answer those two things together.
I understand. Sir, if you could just introduce yourself, please.
Rubinsky. I have a suggestion for the work group to consider. There is some levels of provisioning of registration data that would be useful for users, that such provision could be into the DNS system as well. One example would be...
Carry on, sir. Carry on.
One example would be a user that doesn't want to do business with domains that are hidden under proxy, under proxy WHOIS, under proxy registration data, that such a flag could be published into the DNS. So the user's browser could then select, oh, this guy is hidden from behind a proxy, this guy is not. So there are some usages of provisioning of registration data that could be used in real time by the users. So we should not only focus on who is as something to look at and after the fact, but something to look at while we are browsing the internet. That's what you would like to consider.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So we're going to move on to the next one now. And who's running that one?
Hi.
Thank you.
Susan.
So
we're also looking at the data requirements. Registrant classification was a hot topic. We're looking at the uses of domain names, and does that change what people have a right to in the information displayed for a domain name? Some may be entitled to privacy. Some may not, depending on how the domain name is used. It's you know, we're considering the use of, is there a commercial use for a domain name? I think everyone has the right to know who they're doing business with on the internet, and so it's a natural place to go to as one of the checkpoints. We're also looking at identification of data elements. We've looked at a lot of use cases, struggled with how the data elements currently collected are used. and had a very hard discussion of, you know, should all these data elements even be collected? Do we need a registrant admin and technical contact? Some of the, in a lot of cases, those are all duplicate information. We're also looking at data elements not currently displayed. And should this be expanded? I know that's controversial, but we need to look at the whole picture to come to an agreement and a new design for the directory service. We're also looking at those data elements, you know, what should be required, what should be displayed. Those could be two different answers there. So, you know, there's different uses for the info. If it's a technical issue, someone needs to be contacted, and it needs to be pretty quick. If it's malware or botnets or consumer protection, free speech, law enforcement, IP, we're trying to consider every element and every use. So the question today for you is, should data requirements differ for domain names for commercial versus non-commercial use?
Thank you, Susan. Elliot, are you standing at the microphone? Unusually.
As is Wendy.
Wendy. So should I be able to have my own personal domain name completely privatized, and Facebook obviously would have its domain name with information is basically the question. Let's go to Wendy first.
Thanks. Wendy Seltzer, non-commercial stakeholder. And I would say that while that may seem intuitively like an appealing distinction, it's not one that ICANN should be making because it's too fuzzy a line to enforce in the collection and provision of public registration information. There are places in law that may impose requirements on commercial sites that can be fulfilled in other ways than through the WHOIS, but to tell individuals if we were to try to make this distinction, we would then get into questions of, is the use of AdWords on a personal website transform it into a commercial site? Does the provision of a link to the site that is selling the book that I wrote transform it into a commercial site? Does the linking to sites that offer affiliate fees for sending you over to make a purchase or a subscription transform a use into a commercial use? While those are uses in commerce, I think they are also uses that fund a great deal of nonprofit and non-commercial and individual expression and speech. So trying to draw those distinctions would just either involve us in a morass of finer and finer line drawing and ultimately chill what we should recognize as legitimate free expression without those.
Thank you, Wendy. Thanks and congratulations on getting a mention of the book that you wrote into your thing.
Hypothetically, unfortunately.
Elliot.
Thank you, Chris. Elliot Noss with Two Cows. I have now heard what I would describe as a red herring three separate times in the brief moments since we've started, which is that consumers, and this is about consumer protection, need to know who they're doing business with. So I consider that a red herring in two or three separate ways. First of all, the place where consumers will find out who they're doing business with will be much more found in the browser bar. If people are transacting online, the site will have an SSL certificate. That SSL certificate will be displayed in every browser bar commonly in use today. And in fact, recently we have the extended validation SSL certificates, which turn the browser bar green. If somebody is unable to parse that information in terms of who they're actually transacting with, I think it's really sophistry or just our imagination that they would then be able to dig a level below that into the WHOIS data to determine who they're doing business with. So we have a huge paradigm already with SSL. The second thing is we need importantly recognize that transactional elements online are a tiny percentage of the web. some well sub 5% of websites are transacting online. The vast majority are informational. We have enough problems today with people finding out where their information is coming from. So, you know, you're talking about a couple levels here. The tiny level that's transactional, maybe some small layer on top of that that, let's call it, professionally informational. Anybody who is in those two layers has a huge competitive incentive to make their information public and accessible. What we're left with is the vast majority of the internet, which is people connecting with and sharing information with other people. And there, the consumer protection or the deep demand, the deep incentive for us to have access to that information to protect users of the internet goes down to something approximating zero. So I really think that what we're doing too often here is taking this tiny little slice and expanding it to make the who is into something it's not.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just want to ask you just a yes or no answer. Do two cows deal with a lot of CCs? Are there any CCs that have that you deal with, that you know, that have differentiation between personal and corporate and in their who is?
Yes.
Thank you. Ray?
Just a point of clarification, we're not talking about who is here.
I apologize, Ray. No, I was actually talking about who is, existing who is,
yeah,
right then.
Right.
Yes.
But other mentions have been made to who is. We're not talking about who is. I have a problem with this differentiation, commercial versus non-commercial. In the end, what we're really reflecting here is activity that is the result of a transaction, either in the establishment of a top-level domain, or we're reflecting a transaction that is a result of a top-level domain issuing, if you will, or recognizing second-level domains. And we're not talking about the registration of websites. And so we need to be clear about that. The information that's being collected is being collected about transactions. Certainly, at some point in time, from one perspective, the domain operator, if you will, is going to be reporting the users, and it's that point where you're reporting the users is where you would see a registration that might pertain to a website. It might pertain to something else entirely different. So we need to keep ourselves in that transactional thought process. And the question of data requirements actually goes back to the first question, which is not only what it is you're collecting, what is the requirement to collect, but also what are you being required to report. And so that's where you really should make the distinction.
Thanks, Ray. I'm going to take Don because he hasn't spoken yet. We are running out of time on this session, so, Kathy, I'll give you a very short time at the end. Don, go ahead.
Appreciate it. Don Blumenthal with Public Interest Registry. I originally was going to raise a point about this economic versus non-economic distinction, but I think Wendy covered it as well as anybody could. Interesting idea, not feasible. I did want to respond to something that Elliot suggested there, though. I used to be in law enforcement, and we advise consumers to check who is records, particularly. And the numbers are growing. You may know generally who you've transacted, but an increasing number of websites don't have basic things like address or phone numbers or any way to get in touch with them except for email, if that. You know, you've got the dial to submit your information, and you don't know where it's going. You may question how useful that information it will be that you get from the domain information. But the fact is consumers do use it. They're advised to by law enforcement. And from experience, I can tell you that they do.
Thanks,
Tom.
They
do check who has records.
Thank you. Real quick, Kathy.
Sure. Kathy Kleiman again. A quick no. This question has always come up across the last 10 years, and it seems like an easy differentiation, commercial versus non-commercial. But what is non-commercial? Nonprofits, collect money. They collect donations. Foundations do too. By virtue of collecting that money, are they suddenly non-commercial? Are they suddenly commercial? No, they're still nonprofits. KathyKleiman.com switches between commercial and non-commercial.
Thank you. Now, Elliot?
Yeah, very briefly, you know, in response to Don's comment, I think that's exactly right. And the Who is a beautiful mechanism. If I'm going to give somebody my money and they don't have information that I want in terms of being able to contact them, I don't give
them my
money.
Don't give them the money. Okay. Thanks, Elliot. Let's take the next one, which is privacy requirements. And I'm guessing that may be Stephanie.
Thanks very much. As our group has been focused on this privacy issue, which I gather has been a key issue for some time, we're mindful that when it comes to data protection requirements, we're operating in a global society. There are differing laws, there are differing jurisdictions, and so the data protection requirements may be slightly different. Nevertheless, they all tend to focus on purpose. So it's important that we understand the purpose for collection, the purpose for use, and the purpose for disclosure, and the impacts that that has on the registration data that we gather. Now, it is obviously clear that this is interesting and useful data for a number of purposes. The job in most privacy regimes is figuring out which ones are relevant and which ones are appropriate, and doing the difficult job of keeping it narrow and restricted to purpose. So understanding what those purposes are is key. We already have registrar local law exceptions that have been implemented. We have discussed whether those are working well and how that's impacting the communities. So no doubt we'll be looking at that further. You see that little blue box on the top? The question has arisen, and we have started discussions on whether it is time for ICANN to develop a privacy policy and what that would look like given a global universe of differing laws and jurisdictions where there isn't law. So I move on to the discussion questions. The first one is whether and how to accommodate anonymous registrations. If we are moving towards greater accuracy, then privacy by obscurity becomes more difficult. There are technological means of providing anonymous registrations. There's also the whole question of how we manage the proxy registration service. And then the second question is, what are the possible safeguards to minimize abuse and protect the privacy of registrants? And abuse, there's various kinds of abuse, and we would encourage you in your comments, too, is to interpret that fairly widely as abuse on all sides.
Thank you, Stephanie. So, anonymous registrations and protecting privacy, which is kind of presumably protected by an anonymous registration, but leaving that aside. Bertrand, you're the first to the microphone.
Yeah, Bertrand Lachapelle from the board. In the discussions I've followed in the past on those issues, I sense that there's this clear distinction between what is, in a certain way, compulsory for legal reasons regarding things that must be protected, particularly for individuals, and depending on the different jurisdictions. And the second question, which is the optional capacity to shield one's visibility behind a proxy service. Those are two very different things, I understand. It turns out that in places where privacy requirements are particularly strong, i.e. in Europe, there's a whole lot of practices among CCTLDs in diverse modalities that you certainly can build upon. The second thing, on the second aspect, the key question is not so much the capacity to have the proxy registration, because they do exist. The key question is under which conditions they are unlocked and by whom.
Thank you, Bertrand. Okay, Carol's got a remote comment from somewhere in the world.
Hi.
Probably next door in the other room, actually, as is usually what happens.
This comment came from Kieran McCarthy. More of a comment or suggestion than a question. One of the big problems with domain registrants' information is ensuring its accuracy, especially as there are so many domains out there. It may be worth using the millions of internet users as a reporting tool, providing a simple mechanism in a browser to flag problems. Rubens suggested Whois could be displayed in the browser Elliot identified the different types of website owners. It may be possible to do what Nominate in the UK does and get people to select whether a site will be used for business or personal. For the business site, you could then display a full registrant's information in the browser. A personal site could have details withdrawn. If the internet user sees something that doesn't make sense, they could do simple click reporting. Obviously, it's just an idea, but it may be useful to consider if you are completely reviewing how to do this.
Thanks, Carol, and thank you, Kieran. I know you're not feeling very well right now, so it's good that you're still able to think. Amadea.
Oh, don't say my name. I'm here anonymously. Couple of questions. You said, Stephanie, that you are considering the models that are out there, but have you asked for statistics about requests for access and requests for communication with those registers that have some sort of privacy for individuals, for instance, .cat, .tel, or in the ccTLDs, .fr, .ca, .uk in different ways? I think that would be interesting because if we try to get things in abstract way, we go from one extreme to the other about freedom of expression or protection of privacy or law enforcement, and we don't look at what really happens when you change one of these parameters. And what's the real impact of that? I mean, we will miss part of the things. In abstract, everything is difficult, right? So, but everything seems simple, but it's difficult. If you see concrete examples, perhaps we'll learn how to handle that. Regarding anonymous registrations and all this part, why do we want anonymous registrations for? I mean, it's not simple. It's not simple to have real registrations with real data not being displayed publicly and only being disclosed for legitimate purposes, instead of having everybody having anonymous and non-accurate data being published. I think that a public who is accessible to everybody, where everything is either incorrect or belongs to a third party that's acting as a proxy, that may be acting responsibly or not, this is probably the worst situation we can have, and it's what we are having now.
Thank you, Amadeo. And to answer your question, we haven't yet, but we will go and get data from those places that do make the distinction between commercial and non-commercial. Ray, Wendy, the lady behind Wendy, hi. That's going to close it, I think. Can I ask you all to keep your comments reasonably brief, Ray?
Question of privacy really has to do with two things. The storage and the provision has nothing to do with the collection. And so collection is what is needed to get the registrations done. And the conditions of what is to be reported and how it's to be reported through the provisioning is where you have to apply the privacy and takes care of all your anonymous registrations and so forth. The storage is protection of all the data, and so so this question really is one that really needs to be taken up inside the areas of both storage and provision. Thanks.
Thank you. Wendy?
Thanks, Wendy Seltzer, and I really welcome this effort that's taking a broader look, that's getting to examine the questions of privacy and anonymous speech that have sometimes been deemed out of scope in the old who is discussions. So very briefly, anonymous speech in the United States is protected by the First Amendment. The rights of free association are protected under the First Amendment. As human rights elsewhere in the world, there are similar protections for the right to speak and associate without providing a name. So as domain names are used as the stable location for...
But Wendy, you don't need to have your own domain name in order to protect your right for anonymous speech, do you? There's plenty of opportunities to speak anonymously.
Yes, you do, in fact. If you want to be able to refer people to the location of your speech without depending on a third party reveal or not reveal your name and the legal pressures that third party might be under or the political pressures that third party might be under, the best way to secure that when you give somebody a pointer, they will be able to follow it to find your speech is to have registered your own domain name. There are second best solutions that plenty of people use, but why should we be relegating the speaker to a second best solution when we've got this great technology for speech?
Okay.
I'm entirely willing to engage in discussions of how we can protect against abuse of the anonymously registered name. As I've discussed in other forums, we could have a rapid takedown procedure. We could have other mechanisms of escrow that would help to ensure that if these names were misused, they could quickly be deactivated. Okay. But I think it's critical to recognize...
Sorry to interrupt your full flow. With respect to your thing about anonymous, are you talking about, do you want full anonymity or do you want protection of identity?
I think if a registrar wants to offer...
No. I don't... That this is... In an ideal world, what would you like?
Do
you
want full anonymity?
You want full anonymity. Okay, that's fine. Just trying to understand what you would like.
We need to move to the last speaker, Wendy, so appreciate it. Thank you.
Hi, it's Umi Okutani. I'm actually from a registry of IP address, and we run a Whois, so just want to share a practice for your reference. We actually have privacy law in Japan that requires us to protect the privacy information of home users, but we also felt that accuracy of the registrants are very important as well. So what we did was that we tried to do both. So we require all registrants to register all the information, including the postal address, phone numbers, etc. But we don't make all the registration data open. So for the home users, we do not disclose the information. And then when we receive our requests from law enforcement agencies, then if it's required under the law, then we disclose those data, if it's necessary to be used for, spamming or phishing or those kind of, situation. So
excellent.
That's what we do. Just for your
reference. No, that's... Thank you. Thank you very much. That's incredibly useful. Okay. Next one. Who's in charge of bad propizio? Off you go.
Oh, thank you. So we've been discussing accuracy requirements and more specifically what requirements there could be for ensuring data accuracy, how those requirements could lead to more reliable data, more quality within data. And I have to say I'm very happy for Amadeo to have teed this up about three times already in the session, which is that you'll see accuracy is something that is a continuing theme, I would say, something that's thread through the prior comments and topics that you've heard and the ones that we will continue to hear about, data accuracy. And to give an example, some of the things that we've talked about based on one of the prior comments, just the prior one, privacy, we've actually discussed how a mechanism to better protect the privacy of users could increase the reliability and quality of data. So just to give you guys an idea of some of the things that we're thinking about. Now, naturally, that topic always turns to also how do you deal with or how do you process people who put in inaccurate data. So we've had many discussions really linked around what happens today. Should those processes change? Is there room for change? Could the processes be better based on what was intended in today's processes? So our question today is should the remedies for inaccurate data differ? And the examples we have are between fraud, criminal, malicious conduct, but not limited to that. We'd love some feedback on if there should be a difference in how you deal with inaccurate data.
Thanks, Fabrizio. This is a no-brainer for some CCs. Of course, if you provide inaccurate data, there should be some kind of sanction, and in some CCs it's... And in some CCs, and the numbers registry, Ray, thank you. And some CCs will take the name away from you, and others will insist that you correct and so on. So what do we think? Does no one care about this one? Or is it just so obvious that there should be sanctions that it's just a question of how big the stocks are in the centre of the village that we taught? Matthew.
Hello, everyone. My name is Matthew Vey. I'm the CEO of AFNIC, Registry of Dalifar. And a number of CC policies have been mentioned, and I think we've been doing a lot in terms of privacy protection and also accuracy for Whois in the last few years. I'm very glad that CA or .cat actually were inspired by our policies. what we do, I think the testimony I can give is, what do we do when we have inaccurate data in DALI 4? It's very simple. It's in French law, so we are bound to do this. Inaccurate data is a reason for domain name takedown. So we do that on a very regular basis under DALI 4. But the law also states very clearly that this takedown cannot happen until the registry has put the registrant in a position to correct the data. Whatever the situation, fraudulent, criminal, malicious conduct, this is not our the policy says we don't have to discriminate between those options, and therefore we have to give a reasonable amount of time to the registrant to correct the data before we take it down.
Thank you, Matthew. We've got, I'm going to give everyone a minute. So, Elliot, 1 minute. Oh, okay, Wendy first. 1 minute.
Thanks.
Actually,
Wendy.
Now 50 seconds, Wendy.
Wendy Seltzer. I think we'll be able to answer this question much better once we have mechanisms for protecting privacy other than the provision of inaccurate data. I mostly recommend deferring answering this question.
Well, hold on. No, let's be specific here. Forget. Let's assume that you have an option to not display the data. Should you be required to provide accurate data to your registrar? So assuming you have an option for it not to be displayed, should there be a requirement for accuracy?
Modulo my earlier comment that you should be able to provide no data because
you should
be permitted to have... I don't... I think... I think it's a better question to answer when we have more information about the privacy options.
Fine. Elliot?
Yeah, two quick comments. First, it is the case, you know, we've heard from a couple CCs, that the CCs that have more restrictive policies around address and accuracy tend to also do worse to much worse competitively relative to the GTLDs.
But if you level the playing field by...
If you're talking, it's not part of my minute, right?
That's right. But if you level the playing field, so that everybody was on the same, roughly the same level, then it doesn't
matter. So you would like ICANN to impose...
I wouldn't like anything, I'm just asking.
...requirements on .au? I just want to... Did we get you on the record on that?
Elias, with all due respect, I mean, what are the top five largest CCTLDs?
I know it insults coming once I hear all due respect, but yes...
Elias, okay. What are the top five CCTLDs at the moment?
Yeah, I don't think it's a quiz. It's going to be DE,
no, but,
UK.
No, but if you're saying... Yeah, okay, so UK has certain differences here, so I'm just wondering...
Yeah, they have differences, but they don't have nearly the same restrictions around residency. The second point
is
that it's impossible to talk about requirements for accuracy in a vacuum relative to who has access to the data and how they have access, because I think it's the way that today the who is abused by some parties who think they should have access that leads to a lot of the anonymity. So I think that those two things in isolation are impossible to answer.
Okay.
And that would be the point of this working group. We're working on it all holistically.
Yeah. Strikes me it's an in principle question, but anyway, I'm going to need to close the line. Patron, you get the last word, but you're going to need to be really quick. Don, go ahead.
Okay, just focusing on the narrow question of differential penalties given what the abuse is, I think you get into yet another definitional quagmire. It's got to be all or nothing because countries' laws vary too much. Individual definitions of what's fraud, what's abuse, what's internet law enforcement vary too much to start getting into that element, that level of detail.
Okay. Thanks, Don. Ray?
The word remedy, choice of the word remedy is useful here. There's two things here with regard. First of all, it's the collection issue. It's how well does a registry or registrar vet the registrant? How well do they know who they are? What kind of checks do they do? The address registries spend an awful lot of time vetting possible registrants to determine whether or not they're spammers and so forth. And so there's a lot of very valid business practices that can be done during the collection phase to ensure that. The second thing that as human nature happens, people change phone numbers and all kinds of other things, so there has to be a plan to refresh the data, if you will. And so periodic refreshment of the data where a re-registration type activity is a case of that. If you take the idea that if it's sanctions, I'll leave that up to the lawyers to figure out how big the stock should be or how high the guillotine should be.
Thanks, Ray. Amadeo, 1 minute.
Okay, one thing regarding complete anonymity. This could pose serious trouble from the contractual point of view to many registries and registrars. They may accept, you know, my name is Mickey Mouse, but not, they cannot sign a contract with somebody saying, I don't give you my name, I don't give you my address, I don't give you an email for contact when the name has to be renewed. But that's a side point. The other question regarding accuracy. Please, I trust Michele to have dealt with that, but accuracy and the quality of the data are two things different. I manage domain names for many of my friends that don't want to know about who is and things like that. And some of the data is not accurate because they have moved physically.
Sure.
So it's the all, you know,
it's
physical
reliable.
Address is still there. But, you know, they are still reachable. The email works, the
yes.
telephone works. So this is what is important, that the data is enough to get useful communications, right?
Which is why we have the word reliability up there. Reliable data is, we think, probably more important than accurate data, Steve.
Yes, Steve Metalitz. My answer to this question would be no if you're talking about the remedies within the registry and registrar world. But as people have mentioned, national law has an impact here too. And in some countries have yeah. greater penalties for committing crimes using in which you use false data. And finally, I would just mention that data accuracy and quality.
Thank you.
No surprise to you that when those parties who are violating the terms of who is explicitly don't get the level of access that they want, they complain to ICANN about it and, you know, and look for things like SLAs around their access that's an abuse yeah. of the term. So, yes, tiered access is a great thing.
Super. Thank you. Amadeo.
A resounding yes on the principle, and yes, the problem is implementation. The question here is that when you do that for CCTLD, it's easier because you have easy contact to your local law enforcement. When you do that for a GTLD, the question here is that we will need the help of Europol, Interpol, and the GAC to have prepared a list of
sure.
contacts we can use for that. It cannot be the individual work of each registry and registrar because they will make serious mistakes in that. And same for IP rights enforcement agencies or companies, etc. We will need the help of that industry to help identify and certify the people that should do that. Okay.
Thank you. Amadeus, so I've just realized we've lost the scribes.
Yeah.
Okay, they're working on it. Cool. Steve.
Yes, Steve Metalitz. If I had a one-word answer, I guess it would be no, and probably basically for the reasons that Bill Smith said. This really gets back to my initial concern, which was if there is going to be tiered access, we have to make sure that everybody who may have a legitimate interest in this, every Internet user, is in a tier somewhere. So we don't want to have a solution that works for law enforcement, that works for big trademark owners, that works for others, but doesn't really work for the public
sure.
as a whole.
I think there's an assumption that, I mean, I may be wrong, there's certainly an assumption on my part that the tiered access starts at a level that is open to everybody. What data is contained in that is a different issue, but I understand your point.
And that no level would be zero. I just would finally say that our status quo is we have anonymous access to this information. I think there are actually, I'm sure Wendy would agree with me that there are probably some very important benefits to that we want to try to preserve.
Yeah, okay. Bertrand.
The term tiered access evokes implicitly a hierarchical scale. Like there is a lower level, a middle level, a high level, and so on. I personally have a preference for the expression that I used before, which is differentiated technical modalities of access, because it allows for something that is not hierarchical, but that can be cross-cutting, diagonal. Give you an example. There can be very interesting academic studies done from the bulk data completely anonymized, if this is possible. I know that there are limits, but having the bulk for academic study is extremely useful. Having law enforcement access for one layer of information, even an automated capacity to screen is possible also, and you can imagine systems where the requests are being logged to enable later audits. So thinking about how not only the requester's purpose, but also the requester's allowance to access the data under certain conditions, you could have, for instance, law enforcement access free to a certain type of data easily and different depths of access. Okay. But the logging and the capacity to audit is a very important element afterwards because it has a sort of chilling effect on the abuse.
Thank you. I think we're done on this one. Yes? Anyone, just because we've got, like, we do have a minute, does anyone on the panel want to say anything about tiered access? Just very quickly. Okay. I just wanted to see if anybody wanted to say anything about tiered access. Stephanie already has.
No, I'll speak to that very quickly. I mean, okay. Something, what we've been trying to do throughout this exercise today is going back to the very, very basics, as in which elements of data are required at a technical level and then moving from there on up. So speaking to Steve's point, you know, it's impossible technically for a domain name to resolve on the internet without some data being accessible to the public, unless you come up with some new protocols, and I'm sure you can monetize that, but, you know, that's at a technical level, it's just not going to happen. So you'll always have a certain amount of access.
Stephanie wanted to say something, and then we'll
I just wanted to respond on the comments about this more articulated vision. I totally agree, and you certainly don't want to lose research and statistical analysis. And the problem, of course, is that this balances with the response burden on the community that's providing this. If they have to evaluate each request, that can be burdensome. I mean, there's a reason why things are open now. We have to figure out how we calibrate this. But I think more complexity is, ironically, better than less complexity.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to close now with the last two, Bill and then Kathy.
Bill Smith, PayPal. In any form of access that requires identification, one of the things that we should be concerned about is not only the privacy of the individuals who are registering domains, but the privacy of those who are asking about them. And that is, potentially is a much more serious concern because of who is actually maintaining that data, the logs, et cetera. And so that's something the working group, I believe, should consider if you're going to come back and suggest tiered or some other form of access.
Thanks, Bill. Finally, Kathy, real quick.
Just a real quick, this is a great conversation. We should have been having it for years. Tiered access and the privacy of those registering domain names and the access to that data and the privacy of those trying to access that data and the privacy of that data. Okay. Great discussion. Thank you.
I'm going to give the last word on this to Stephanie. And we're moving on.
I was pretty brief on the discussion of the potential privacy policy, but everybody should understand that a potential privacy policy looks at all individuals, all data, and there would be different rules for the different areas. So that's a complex beast. It's not just about what goes out on
Absolutely.
The new who is.
Okay. Next one. Last one, I think. Yes, sorry. All right. Lenry.
I think we would like to obtain comment on if it is reasonable to request for costs to access the registration data. I mean, should we be in a mechanism where users will pay some fee to access a certain level of
excellent. I agree that we should get some comment on that, but not right now. There's an email address that everyone can send there. I've no doubt people have comments about that. Absolutely they do. Storage and performance requirements, which is Faisal, I think.
Yep.
Faisal, over to you.
So this is the how of what happens to the data, specifically how the data is stored. We briefly discussed two different models, a distributed model, which currently exists right now, and a second model, which is a centralized database, which is a central place where all the data would be housed. There are challenges and advantages to both. With so many additional registries coming on, the question is a distributed model might be more challenging at that point. But perhaps there may be different flavors of a distributed model. Regardless of which model is adopted, however, there may be certain metrics which need to be put into place in order to evaluate performance. Perhaps spot checks, periodic audits. There will also need to be security mechanisms which would be implemented within the system itself. For example, with a centralized database, you can manage access by requiring credential information, or you can manage tiered access. But Bertrand says it's differentiated technical modalities. That's how you do it. We might need to have redundancy by providing for an escrow holder. But with a centralized database, the question then becomes, who will manage this database, and what are the ancillary costs attendant to that? And are there going to be, are we going to be charging, as somebody just brought up now, to access? So we haven't really gotten into this topic, and we kind of scratched the surface on it. That's why I think it's so important to get your feedback. And the question is, what are the costs and/or benefits of a distributed versus centralized database?
Okay. There must be some registrars in the room, apart from Elliot. No offense, Elliot, that have an opinion about centralized database, or possibly some registries. Chuck, maybe. I'm going to start with Ray.
So I presume you're talking about this in relation to a single GTLD.
Yes.
Whether or not each one would have either a centralized or a distributed database.
Well, no, that's possible that you could have an overall centralized database for all GTLDs.
So you're talking about every GTLD, the data collected by every GTLD would be one master.
There's an organization in Geneva that has the database that's in, you know, all of that stuff.
I would be totally opposed to that model to begin with.
Okay.
Answering that question inside each GTLD, I would propose you could almost leave it up to the GTLD to decide, but what you need to have are rules and processes that they have to follow in order to do that. The big thing that has to be done here is our process and control audits of the factors that you mentioned there, and that's probably more important than anything else. Having a policy or sets of rules, which are guidelines, whatever term you want to use for every GTLD, so that they can choose whether they care to do a distributed database or centralized database, I think would be a better solution.
So let's get clear. Let's just get clear for a second. Under the new GTLD contracts, every new GTLD has a thick whois, or whatever we're going to call it, and that means that is run from one location, right? So registry. So we already have that for all the new GTLDs. So it is more about a centralized database across the whole of the space, and whether that is something that, and which you said no to, but
I say no to 30,000 GTLDs being all their data being in one database.
Okay.
That's not scalable. But I do say that you should have a choice between whether or not each GTLD should have a choice, and you actually have to provide the rules for it to happen. And the most important thing in that regard is that you have to have process control audits.
Got it, Bertrand.
Bertrand Lachapelle. Not sure it's a completely either-or. The fact is that the collection of data is decentralized by nature, as Chris was mentioning, so it's a crowdsourcing system. The second thing is, if there is enough standardization or protocols that are clear, there is the possibility, even if they are maintained separately, to allow people to make the gathering, and there may be several actors gathering this type of data for different types of users. The choice that is being made is whether, that is apparently presented, is whether there is a single thing that becomes the exclusive reference point, or whether the distributed bases are the reference points and there are different modes of aggregation. That being said, if you look at the root server model, it is also a single database that is distributed. So it's not an either or. It can be a distributed system of access with single database.
That's absolutely right. You are correct. In fact, I think we actually talked about that at some point. Chuck.
Thanks, Chris. Chuck Gomes from VeriSign.
First of all, some historical information. Original, I think it was Network Solutions Agreement. It could have been VeriSign, but actually required us to be prepared to offer both two concepts, centralized WHOIS, which was across TLDs, not just the TLDs we operated, and universal WHOIS, which would have included CCs, and we quickly discovered that CCs might never cooperate on that, so we didn't go that route. I won't repeat what you said, Chris, but I was going to make the same point with regard to the fact that right now, registries, in thick registries, all the data is fed up anyway. I guess the last thing I would say, I would question, and I'd like to talk to Ray further about this, why a centralized solution would not be scalable. We have a pretty large database for quite a few names coming from hundreds of registrars. So I'm not sure, and I'm not the technical person that's the right person to answer that, but I think it might be scalable.
Okay, we can, as you say, you can talk about that offline.
Rubens. Continuing on Bertrand's point, it's possible to have a distributed database with centralized authentication and logging purpose.
That's correct, it is.
So the database could be everywhere, but could recognize centralized emitted certificates for law enforcement authorities, privacy authorities, yes, and so forth.
Thank you, and that's an extremely good point. I can't remember who said it earlier on, but there was talk about how I think Amadeo said there's talk about how difficult it is to recognize law enforcement across borders and so on and so forth. One of the possible ways of advantages of that sort of thing is that you only have to go through that once centrally for the law enforcement. You don't have, not an individual registrar has to do it, so thank you. Steve.
Steve Metallitz. I think we're in violent agreement that this is not an either-or question. The
Absolutely.
Only point I wanted to add is that the WHOIS review team, which has not been mentioned very much this morning, although we've heard from several of its members.
We've talked about them an awful lot amongst ourselves.
And one of their recommendations was that ICANN should establish a centralized portal to all of that registration data for GTLDs. And as I understand it, all those recommendations have been approved by the ICANN board. So we are in the process, I guess, of coming somewhere on this spectrum, at least as far as a centralized portal is concerned. That's my understanding.
Thank you, Steve. Amadeo.
Trying to be very brief first, no to an uber, mega, super duper registry having all the data of everybody and applying the same rules to everything, because one of the problems we have here, not the whole problem, but one of the problems we have is for registries and registrars complying to local law. You have a single rule for everybody with a single, you know, probably somewhere between Dallas Airport and the Pentagon, somewhere there,
by
miracle, that would not help. The other question is yes to what Ruben said, and I was just coming here to say, what we need is to centralize the accreditation of the requesters and the orders to the registry that this is really a valid request. This is something that also we've been discussing with the anti-phishing working group in a very different context.
Understood. Sir.
My name is Andrew Sullivan. I work for Dyn, but I don't speak for them. Two points. First of all, the analogy with the root zone is a little awful because the root zone is tiny, and we're talking about all of the registration data here, so I think it's a bad idea. Secondly, and more importantly, we already have experience with the idea that you're going to have more than one person have the same data, right? Because we had the so-called thin WHOIS in which we had the registry and the registrars have the data. And then we had multiple registrars who had the data. And then we had a problem about communicating that data and shipping it around. So it seems to me that adding yet another layer to the same sort of problem is a bad idea. This is fundamentally a distributed system. Therefore, we should have a distributed database.
Thank you. Bertrand's going to have the last word on this. The next bit is our open session on, you can comment on any aspects of this that you want. You can talk about the costs issue that Lanre brought up as to whether it would be possible to charge for this. You can talk about anything to do with next generation registry services that you like. So if you've got other things to say, come to the microphones, Bertrand.
Yeah, Bertrand Lachapelle. Just one point. It turns out that the kind of questions that we're addressing in the case of WHOIS, particularly regarding law enforcement access to this, is similar to other types of issues that are faced, for instance, in the relationship between law enforcement and large platforms, such as Facebook or others.
because they own a lot of data about the activities of their users. And to do a little bit of self-advertisement, the program I run on internet and jurisdiction at the moment is precisely dealing with what we call procedural interfaces between the different operators, between the law enforcement, the companies, be it DNS operators or ISPs or platforms in the internet space, but also civil society groups, in order to make the triangle a series of interoperability procedures that guarantee due process and streamlining of interactions in a as automated manner as possible with as much checks and balances as possible. So there are similarities in other issues.
Thank you, Bertrand. So the final one is anything else? If we can have the next slide up, please. Okay, they're working on it. No one wants to talk about charging for access to this data at all? Everyone's happy with that idea? Good. Just tick that one off. Not a problem, we can charge.
So we've now solved all our problems.
We've solved all our problems because we can charge, exactly.
I mean, the thing is this...
Perfect,
Elliot's up with the mic.
Exactly. Elliot, off you go.
Were you just killing dead air there, Michaela? I think that Bertrand does, and I wanted to get to this in sort of a closing, that, I think that Bertrand has raised a great point, which is, we need recognize that what we are doing with the Who Is system is, we are public stewards of a resource, which is the DNS. There are numerous private resources like Facebook, Google, and others who not only are potentially more appropriate for deep dives on data around people's driver's license for the internet, which is what a lot of people would like to turn Who Is into, but also are governed by legal regimes and contractual regimes that make that access, that deeper level of access, more appropriate. We are stewards of a public resource here. This should be the resource where there is the most privacy protection for individuals, where people, which is what the internet is about, where people are able to access and use this resource in a way that allows for the most sharing and the easiest way to get communication out. It should not be the lowest common denominator, but should be the highest. And so, I always find it deeply ironic when there are calls, for this resource being the one that is the tightest regime around privacy and individuals' rights.
Understood. Okay. Peter, I'm going to go to you. I think that gentleman's just counting the number of people in the room. It's going to go to Peter, then I'm going to Jim, then to Carol, then to Steve. Peter.
Peter Dengate Thrush, speaking in a personal capacity. Chris, I wanted to just respond in this open session to your throwaway line that it was a license, because to me that begs one of the very fundamental questions that
Correct.
We should be looking at, and I hope the panel is looking at that, because that in many jurisdictions it is a license, but in
Correct.
Many other jurisdictions
Correct.
It
yes.
isn't.
Yes.
And there are people who think that this is actually a fundamental human right, and there are other paradigms and other legal structures that you might use here, for
yes.
example, gift or trust or responsibility. For example, most people would think that everybody in a cinema had an inalienable right to a really good means of egress if there was a fire, without having to register their name to be able to get out of that cinema. And people who travel in wheelchairs, for example, mobility challenged people in many countries have a right to access by ramps, etc., to and from buildings. You don't have to register the wheelchair to get access to some of these rights. So I think a very important
That's
discussion
is
what is the nature of it, what is the legal paradigm? Because if you just start with the presumption that it is a license, then you are imposing, creating a situation where the licensor, potentially in this case ICANN, is going to be able to roll out and dictate conditions all the way down the line. And I'm just not sure that's a safe assumption. So what is the nature of it has to be looked at as well.
Thanks, Peter. Jim.
Yeah, hi, Jim Prendergast, the Galway Strategy Group. I may be getting ahead. There may be another slide. I'm not quite sure. But
no, there isn't.
Okay. Question pertains to timing. I know originally when the work plan said that a product would probably be delivered in April or May, but I'm sensing from today's discussion that's we're probably a little ways off. Do you have any estimate on when there may be a document? And also, what will be the internal process you will use to produce that document? Will it be consensus? Will it be dissension? How's that whole process going to work, if you've figured it out yet?
Jean-François, do you want to briefly address that?
Yeah, in the timeline, I think it's quite difficult to estimate because I think this is a big, big issue that, as you can understand from different and various aspects that the question we're reflecting today. But I believe that if we were having the possibility to have a blueprint before Durban, I think it would be a great, great achievement for this team.
And it's consensus, generally speaking.
Absolutely.
And so I think the what we can say pretty for sure is fewer than 10 years, Jim. Carol.
Hi. This is from a remote participant, Jolene McPhee. I thought that it was a fair point about reliability, that it matters often enough to know that one can reliably contact a registrant as knowing who they are.
Thank you, Carol. Steve?
Steve Metallitz. I just want to dissent from the idea that Elliot proposed about this. Who is, or I should say, the GTLD registration data database, looked at as a whole, is a public resource. And it is a resource that is extremely important to accountability and transparency on the Internet. ICANN has been the steward of that resource for about the last 15 years. And in my view, ICANN has not done a very good job as that steward. There have been many challenges, but I think the data is less accessible and probably less accurate today than it was then.
Can you just
So I think what this group is doing is extremely important to try to improve the management and the stewardship of that very important public resource.
Just very quick, who decided it was a public resource? Why? I mean, if it wasn't here, would we make it one?
Yes, I think if we didn't have something like this, we would have to invent it because people, Internet users, need to be able to find out who they are dealing with online.
Okay. I noticed Wendy's playing microphone hop, which is fine. Patron, could you let Carol do her remote participant before you? Thank you.
Thank you. This one's from Kieran McCarthy.
Again.
Since we are talking about the next generation of services, I think the working group should make sure that you engage the browser companies such as Google, Microsoft, Mozilla, etc. They may have some really good ideas.
Thank you, indeed. Bertrand?
Bertrand Lachapelle. Actually, I'm not absolutely sure that it is a public resource, but I would qualify it rather as a public service. There's an equivalent of a land record type of function here. The who is or whatever directory services is the equivalent of what we call in French the cadastre or the land records. And this dovetails with a general description of what the activity and one of the fundamental responsibilities of ICANN. ICANN has a fundamental responsibility in terms of a notary function. The root is a notary function. The supervision of the directory services and establishments of the rule of the land records is a notary function. So in this respect, it's not a steward of the resource. It is a steward of the process that manages this public service. The second point is a methodological issue. I'm very happy that the board has taken the decision to launch this exercise and to open up the debate. In terms of procedure, I understand that the role of this working group is basically to frame the issue for further discussion. Can you explain a little bit the articulation between what you do, where you stop, and the next steps?
Yes, but not right this second in a little while. Wendy.
Thanks. So as we're wrapping things up, I wanted to offer some different visions of what we're doing, and the Internet is a tremendous platform for speech. It is a tremendous platform for communication and connection among people, and we should be very careful that we not set up rules that restrict those communications opportunities. We have a a tendency to think in terms of commerce and mandated contact, but let's also think about free expression and the tremendous opportunities that this brings for contact among people from all different jurisdictions and all different backgrounds. Let's think in terms of those freedoms.
Thank you, Wendy. Can I have the last slide up, please? Bertrand, I'm going to get back to you in a second. So we have as Jean-Francois said, we have an email address, input to ewg@icann.org. That's open for anyone to provide their input. Please do so. You can track progress on the wiki. And as he said, draft blueprint by Durban meeting, which is certainly our goal. I'm going to hand back to Jean-Francois in a second. Bertrand, there's a very specific wording about the output of this experts working group going to the GNSO. I don't want to preempt that wording, so when we've got it, I'll give it to you. I'd like to thank everybody for their participation. Jean-Francois, back to you.
Thanks, Chris, for being the very, very good moderator for this session. I think it's not so obvious to assemble all these different thoughts from different angles, but as we said, we came here in a very, very humble way, and I think you responded extremely, extremely well, probably overpassed our expectation in terms of how many valid input we collected in all the six domains that we were really seeking for your creativity and insight. So really thanking every one of you in the room. As I said, we'll have this line open in such a way that we will be able to respond. I think Alice is going to put a process such a way we can be organized to respond. So the journey doesn't finish today. It's just really the kickoff for really inviting the community to help us to shape up this, I think, fantastic opportunity to make this new generation of GTLD directory services working, and that people will definitely enjoy it and don't complain anymore that ICANN is making things slower and lower level. So once again, thank you very much for listening to where we are today, but really, really big thank you for you for having so many good insights that we'll take into big consideration. Thank you.